Welcome back to the Strongest Ride Podcast, or welcome to the Strongest Ride Podcast if it is your first episode. Thank you so much for coming along the journey. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening to our rambles. We have a fantastic episode for you today, as always. But before we get into today's guest, Lydia, give us a quick debrief. Nah, you can take your time.
A quick debrief, gosh, you're getting harsher and harsher every single week.
I've got to, otherwise we'll be here all day.
Okay. Wow. Rude. Well, you know what I've been doing recently is I have
running?
Now that you ask, I've been checking my elevation on Strava because I've just been really trying to pay attention to my body and how I'm feeling, how the body is, all those good things, muscles, tendons.
Sorry, bones. I'm going to interrupt you. If I had a dollar for every time you said all those good things, rich I would be. Someone go back through and listen to them all and tell us how many there are. But it's a great sentence. Like, I'm glad it's not all those bad things, you know? It's really, really positive.
I say it to patients too. And sometimes they look at me like, what are these good things you're talking about?
My leg is broken. It's okay. It's good to, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, sorry.
Look, I'm being paying attention to elevation because obviously, as you guys know, I'm being rehabbing my hamstring, my proximal hamstring tendon, and it is coming along very well, which is awesome. And I'm slowly trying to introduce more and more heels. But it's not something that I've really paid attention to because I've just been trying to do the absolute least amount as possible. But now that I'm starting to do more and more, I'm like, oh, cool. I should actually pay attention to what the elevation is because I'll, you know, be able to see, okay, I've done a similar amount week to week and my hamstring's feeling whatever it's feeling. And yeah, I've actually increased the elevation a little bit. And I sort of went back and looked at the start of my injury, and me avoiding heels was not great at the start. Like, I was definitely still running on heels because it's so hard to avoid them. Like, when you live in the east and when you live close to the coastline and there's all the tracks up and down and you just want to go up and down all the time. Anyway, basically I've been paying attention, and the last 2 weeks I hit exactly 1200 meters of elevation, which I don't know like what my normal is because I just do not pay attention. So I have no idea what I was doing pre-injury, but that's definitely more than what I was doing maybe a month ago. I think I was like more like 500 to 600. So big improvement and no symptoms from my hamstring. Tiny bit of tightness sometimes here and there, like if I'm a bit stiff, I've been sitting down for a long time. But yeah, really good. Did 30Ks today and I think I did like 29.7, but yeah, I've then like sat down and done some work on my laptop and I feel nothing, which is so nice. Like, I think that's a huge win, doing a long run and then sitting down for a few hours doing some work and not thinking about my hamstring.
Yeah, that's huge.
It is.
Well done.
Yeah. Proud of you. Thank you.
Very exciting. And
do you want to know about my perineal as well?
I would love to.
It's great. It's really good. No, no symptoms, zero symptoms. And one other update, I've been slack with my calf raises. Yeah. Wow,
tables have turned. I'm now the calf raise queen.
I was the calf raise queen.
Yeah, I know. You've lost your title.
Yeah, the last 2 weeks, I've been so slack. Like, I've probably done a couple of sets just like randomly at work, just in between patients. I'm like, oh, I'll just do one set of six and then that's it. So either my patients need to all start coming late to appointments, so I've got time to do them, or I just stay back after work for 10 minutes and actually do my calf raises, or I could just do them in the gym like I used to do. But I'm trying to be more efficient and maximize my time in the gym and like just tack my calf raises on throughout the week so that I don't do them straight before I run. That's kind of like the thought.
Right. I have a question for you.
Yes.
In your gym sessions, are you doing any supersets?
No, because I'm there for maximal strength gains and I want to rest my central nervous system.
Okay. Could you add a couple of calf raises in while you're resting, seeing as it's quite a small muscle group? And I think that if you're going to either not do calf raises or do them in between your powerful heavy squats, I think the rewards outweigh the risks of you not getting to your maximum power by having a couple of calf raises chucked in.
No, I'm happy to superset if I'm doing like an upper body exercise for a calf raise, but I'm not going to superset it with like a squat or a deadlift or a Bulgarian. No, I'm not getting the most out of my leg exercise. I'm not supersetting a leg exercise with another leg exercise.
Well, why don't you superset it with your upper body stuff then?
Well, you know what? Maybe I will. So, like,
great. I'm glad we've figured this out. Oh, I'm just trying to help. I am a strength and conditioning coach after all. So, just trying to solve your problems, you know?
All right. Dips and calf raises coming. Right.
Dips. Oh, right.
No, okay. Ocean dips. Ocean dips are
hot.
Oh my gosh. I've got one more anecdote from my week, and you'll appreciate that I use the word anecdote.
It better be good.
I had quite a scary experience on my run. So now let me tell you.
Yes. I want to know about this.
Yes. Oh my goodness. So I wouldn't say I'm scared of the dark. I run mostly in the dark and I really enjoy it because the stars out, the moon's out, and I feel like it's a really nice time to just connect to nature and hang out, listen to the sounds of the wilderness. And mostly it's pretty quiet in the mornings. And I really enjoy that time. Really love the stargazing. It's awesome. And I was thinking, because I had somebody tell me recently, they're like, what is the south part of Maroubra like? I'm not trying to name and shame Maroubra because I think it's awesome. I think it's wonderful. And I run around. Oh gosh, here I am giving away my identity and my location.
Be careful.
There's no serial killers listening to this. Anyway, someone said to me, they were like, do you know that it's dangerous in that car park? You know, we might beep out the name of the location. Do you know that it's dangerous in that south
wait,
end?
Pause. I don't know how to beep things out, do you? We've never had to do that. Wait, I'll say beep and then I'll add that in as a little extra.
Okay, good. So anyway, going down to
beep.
And I go there all the time, and I was saying to this person who asked me, do you feel nervous running down there? Do you feel nervous running in the dark? And I was like, honestly, no, I probably am very privileged to feel like that. But truthfully, I don't feel nervous when I go running in the dark in the bush, because the bush for me is a happy place. I feel very safe running in the bush. I feel very comfortable. It's something I've done basically my whole life. And so, no, I don't feel fearful. I take precautions. I take my phone, but I'm actually very comfortable. But anyway, I'm going down to this national park in the dark at 5 a.m., classic Lydia activity, and enjoying the stars in my zone. And I don't have my head torch because I never bother with a head torch because you can't see the stars as much when you've got a head torch.
I did wonder about your head torches, right? I was literally running on Friday with my head torch on thinking, does Lydia eat like ever run in a head torch? I don't know why it just suddenly came to my mind.
Well,
do you, how do you not fall over?
Well, my running gets slow. It definitely gets slow. For anyone who's run with me and they've been running in the dark, they will notice that I am quite slow when it's dark and then there's like uneven terrain. But it's only slow if there's someone who's nearby who's holding a head torch, because then that light interferes with your eyes. And your pupils start to constrict again to protect from the light. And then you look back in the dark and then it's really dark. So if you're on your own, yes.
This I was going to say, I think, yeah, but if you had a head torch on, I don't think that would be an issue. You would be fine.
No, it wouldn't.
So the issue is you don't have a head torch. That
no, I have a head torch.
Yeah.
I just choose to improve my ability to see the stars. And if I had a head torch, you can't see the stars as well. I tried it the other week because I was like, let me give it a go. And I was running in the dark around Bondi and I was like, I'm just going to do it. And oh my gosh, I ran way faster. I could actually run properly, but I couldn't see the stars as well. So halfway through, I turned the head torch off. When I said head torch, I turned my phone light off.
And it's all wrong. It's all wrong. This is just no good.
Anyway,
carry on with your story.
Back to the story. Phone I'm torch. In this unnamed location running, enjoying the sights and the stars, and something ran at me. Some animal ran at me and I just got the fright of my life. I literally squealed. I don't know if I squealed. It was probably like a, and I was so scared and I just like stopped and then I like didn't quite know what to do. And then it was like half off the path and I was like, oh my God, what is it? It's a bear. And obviously it wasn't a bear, but I thought it was a dingo because not that long ago I saw a dingo when I was camping and I was like, oh my God, it's a dingo. Like the dingo is back. And I was like, why? Like, what is this dingo doing? And I was like, Lydia, it's just a dog. It's fine. But it was sitting there on the path, like a couple meters away from me. And I was kind of standing there looking at it. And I just didn't know what to do because it wasn't going. And normally animals in the bush, the rule of thumb is animals are more scared of you than you're scared of them. So I was like, this poor guy, he's scared. Why is he sitting there still looking at me? I was like, he's curious. This guy's not scared. He was ready to come back for attack number two. And anyway, so I was just like, this is, yeah, I was like, oh my God, like, this is it. Pause the Garmin. I'm going home.
What was the Garmin? Leave the Garmin running. You want that content.
Also, I didn't.
Heart rate data.
Yeah, it would have been high. I got out my phone with my flashlight, but I didn't put it in its face. I like put it on me so it could see me.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Look how big and tough I am.
No, I was trying to like, yeah, let him know. Like, look, Lydia's
here. Let him know who's boss. I wish we could see this unfolding. I would love to see you and this like tiny possum going for it.
I then was like, oh my God, okay, I guess I'll just run home. And so I like walked past it and it was just sitting there and I was like, okay, I don't think it's a dingo anymore. I think it's a fox. And then I could see it starting to like walk backwards and it looked like it was like almost sliding on the ground. Anyway, I then started running back home. I only got a couple hundred meters and then I turned around. I was like, what am I doing? That's so silly.
You went back
like,
in.
Yeah, of course. I went back. Wow, I came back and I conquered.
So courageous.
But I did. It was just like the fox can't beat me. Like I'm braver than the fox. So yeah. I came back, but this time with the light on and my hand was a bit like
I thought
like
you were going to say with a weapon.
No, it was just me. Anyway, I finally got to like the main part of the national park and there's a fucking gate and I was like, oh my God, like the gate is locked, like this is it. And anyway, I just unlocked it and just went right in. Yeah,
why was it locked? Is it for the gunshots?
Well, I know, I was a little bit nervous, but I just opened it. It wouldn't open. Okay, it wasn't fully unlocked. I had to like squeeze through. And the same time, this big huntsman came out and almost jumped on me. I was like, wow, nature is really alive this morning. Like the nature was strong. Anyway,
but you were stronger. I went in.
I was stronger. I was braver. I did my run. I came home. It was literally a 6K run or a 7K run. And all that happened in that short space.
Busy. Yeah. Wow. So, that was a great anecdote. I appreciate you sharing.
I'm so glad you appreciate it. Tell me about yourself, Sophie.
Like. Oh, I don't even know where to start now. I'm feeling like we're sitting around a campfire telling stories. I do feel scared in the bush, but that's for another
day.
I don't know if we've ever actually shared that. I know we've mentioned it a few times. I had a scary bush experience. Anyway, not for today. All right. Talking about me. My time to shine. Well, you didn't even mention it, but I had a fantastic run this morning with my best friend Lydia.
Oh, that's
nice. That was really nice. Actually, you know what's really good is that it was 90 minutes, 15 and a half Ks, which is good for me right now. I'm on the comeback. Remember those days of like me doing 5 Ks and be like, oh, can't get past 5 Ks. I've tripled it. So that's progress.
You had a very quick turnaround the last
Well, time. I don't think so.
No.
It's been, what, like 10 weeks?
No. Are you serious?
Yeah, it's gone long. It's been real long. So I think it's kind of an appropriate timeline. And I'm quite pleased with the progress. I did 11 last week and then just some shorter runs during the week. And then, 15 and a half today. So really happy with that. I've had a couple of 50-ish K weeks. What, you're looking stunned. I don't know if you're frozen or if you're... Genuinely shocked.
I'm just having all these thoughts around like
about the fox.
Isn't it insane when you're not physically in the injury, it goes so much quicker. Like
your hamstring has been so quick.
No, but that's what I mean. I feel so annoyed at myself that I said that because I just feel like that is so insensitive to the fact that you've been struggling with this for so long, and like I'm struggling with my thing for so long. But isn't it weird because when you're not in someone else's injury. Like, oh yeah, a couple months, a couple weeks, yeah, okay, whatever, like a few days.
Oh yeah, oh,
and
for
yet,
sure.
It's so hard, like no matter, and this is what I think I said to you a little while back about me feeling annoyed about having an injury, because I'm like, surely you should just like become more patient and become more resilient and become more understanding that like this is a part of it and you have time off and you rest and you do the rehab, but somehow like it still can just be so shit again. So like
again.
Well,
12 weeks ago was our Melbourne trip, which is the week that I did 84 Ks, and then it was all downhill after that. So it's been 11 weeks of discomfort, we could say. Anyway, it's coming along. I'm feeling quite pleased with how things are going. Got some orthotics, hoping to sort out my weird ankle situation, but we'll update on that in a little while. But yeah, running is, I'm enjoying it. I've got a few social runs planned this week, hopefully with you on Wednesday in Furies. It should be fun. Hoping to get to King's Cross on Tuesday and all the other fun stuff. So yeah, I'm feeling quite excited. I'm still like thinking about doing City Marathon, but also it's coming around quite quick and I don't know if I can be bothered, to be honest. Like, I don't know. We'll just see. I just haven't signed up yet. I'll just wait and see. But Pilliga Ultra is on the cards. And when I say ultra, I mean 20K. I always struggle with that when something's called an ultra, but you're not actually doing the ultra part of it. But Pilliga 20K. Lydia might be in for the 50. Stay tuned for more updates on that. Yeah, so a couple of fun things. Yeah, September. If anyone else is going to be there, let us know. We were out there in the forest and it's going to be a great weekend. So we will see you there if you're there. But yeah, they're my main thoughts, I think.
And stay tuned for the Stronger Stride running tour of
Sydney. Oh, we need to talk about that. Probably off air. That's way too long for me. 60Ks. Lydia, guys. Lydia sent me this Google Doc. We've been talking a little bit about the Stronger Stride running food tour, which we were inspired by from our Melbourne trip where we just ran around and went to coffee shops and then kept running. She's drawn up this 60-kilometer map. Firstly, like 60Ks is going to take
all day. Most
of the day.
Perfect.
But to like sit down, get some food, have it, like I think we're going to need to allow more time. So my thoughts are way too long, firstly, but we can discuss that later.
Look, if anyone wants to join me for the ultra.
I also think 60K really limits the pool of people who are going to come because not many people are going to just casually want to do a 60K.
Everyone does a casual 60K.
Yeah, just you. Okay. So we'll sort out the details on that. But yeah, stay tuned for that, guys. And also stay tuned for some Instagram lives. We're booking one in for the 19th of this month. I forget where we are. July. Wednesday evening. See you there on the live. Also send through any guest recommendations if you have any and we will get chatting to them. But enough of our jibber jabber. Today's episode is with the wonderful, inspiring, intelligent Christine Yu, who is an award-winning journalist and writer. She has recently written a book called Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. And we talked to her about her book and all about the gender gap in sports science research and how that affects all of us. We talked about history. We talked about the current science. We talked about menstrual cycle, nutrition, endurance, clothing and footwear, kind of covered a lot of bases. And it was a really interesting conversation. Hey, Lydia.
Yeah, I think you literally just pretty much ticked that all off. So we love chatting to Christine and her book is absolutely fantastic. We strongly recommend it. We'll put a link in the show notes and to all of her resources as well. I think this episode is definitely not just for women. It's for everyone. There were some surprising learnings in there as well for me. I think a few things that I just thought I knew about and then Christine shedded some light on them and I was like, oh, wow, like actually hadn't thought of that. And I think there's a lot of stuff that we just get used to accepting in the sporting world as normal and being quite different for men and women. But if we actually look at it, there's some issues and there's some things that I think are emerging and changing. And it was just so great to have Christine on. And yeah, she was just really good energy and a wealth of knowledge. So really can't wait for you guys to listen to the episode. And we know that you're going to get so much out of it. So enjoy the episode. Check out her links. Check out her book. Strongly recommend it. And we know you're going to learn lots of great things.
Welcome back to another episode of the Stronger Stride podcast. Today, we are joined by Christine Yu, who is the author of Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. We're so excited to have Christine joining us today and talking all things about the gender gap within sport, menstrual cycle, nutrition, endurance training, all sorts of different topics we're going to get into very shortly. But Christine, if you would like to introduce yourself and let the listeners know a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm excited to be here. So I am a sports science and health journalist. I've written for a number of different publications from the Washington Post to Outside Magazine to Runner's World to Slate. And I'm the author of the book, Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes, that just came out in May. I live in New York. I'm a runner, although I'm injured right now. But I've been kind of being active and an athlete all my life.
Oh, it's awesome. We're really so excited to hear from you because I think something that Soph and I pointed out to ourselves a few months back, or maybe at the start of this year, is that we realized we actually didn't have that many women come on our podcast. And it wasn't intentionally, it just happened to be that a lot of the experts in the field were men. And I think it's quite reflective of what the science is as well. Like, there just is not as much on women, and myself as a physio, that's something that I guess is an issue at times, because a lot of the research is men. And so when we're trying to apply these things to women, we know that there are actually differences. And now as you know, more research is coming out, things are starting to shift and change. And I think, you know, the first part is awareness. And then when I came across your Instagram, I sent it straight to Sophie. I was like, oh my goodness, this is so exciting. Like, we've got to chat to Christine and hear all about your book. So yeah, just really excited to see a woman in a space paving the way and making it more known about this gap. So it's amazing. It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I would say, like, even as a journalist too, when I'm looking for sources for articles, I have to also just be more conscious too, because it's really easy to default to asking all the men who are sports scientists, exercise physiologists, orthopedic surgeons, like all of them, right? Like, that's who pops up, because they are the predominant folks who are practicing in those fields. So being more conscious of that and, you know, seeking out other more diverse sources too, which I think is really important.
Yeah, it's such a good point, because without even being conscious of it, it is sometimes just an automatic thing. You know, if you just do a quick Google search or whatever you're doing, often it is men that come up first, and you just go, oh yeah, they must know what they're talking about, let's go with that. But I think trying to diversify that and get a broader range of understanding is so important. And I guess to kick things off, do you know why, I guess with your learnings and research that you've gone through, do you know why, I guess, the main reasons for the lack of research on women? Why is there that gap? Where did that sort of start? And I guess, how do you see that changing now and in the future?
Yeah, I think if you ask a lot of the current researchers and scientists, they will tell you that historically, the reason is because women are complicated, right? Because we have menstrual cycles and our hormones are fluctuating all the time in a very unpredictable manner. It makes it hard to do scientific research with women, because if you're trying to isolate, you know, the effect of a single intervention or understand how a specific molecule works or hormone works, you want to eliminate as much extraneous noise from that experiment as possible. And so if you have a fluctuating hormonal environment in the background, it throws a lot of noise into that data. So that means that scientists have to take more time, right, to adjust their data, account for those things. So easier, right, to study men, because their hormonal environment tends to be more stable. So I think, like, historically, that's been the reason that's been used. It's easier, it's less money, you know, you don't have to try to coordinate around women's cycles and how and that's really hard, right? But I think that if you kind of also just look back in history and just think about how the fields of both sports and science were kind of developed, you know, I think it's clear that both of those realms are very much male dominated, right? You know, sports hasn't always been, right, like this realm for men to, you know, display their masculinity, be competitive, like all these things that we associate with being an athlete and playing sports tend to be associated with, like, more masculine characteristics, right? Women haven't always been allowed in those fields. So when scientists really wanted to study the effect of exercise on the body, and then they look around and see, like, who are the athletes, the vast majority of the athletes that they're going to see are going to be men, right? Because those are the folks that have been allowed to participate in sports, who have been, you know, able to train to certain elite levels that, you know, these scientists might want to study. So, you know, it kind of makes sense, right, that that becomes the default, or that becomes, you know, the methodology that is standardized and passed down from, you know, professor to student, and then from student, you know, to their student, and, you know, all the way down, right? It just creates this, you know, almost blind spot, if you will, right? Like, it just becomes the way that you do things, and you don't even think about why you aren't including half the population, right? It's like, that's how my professor did it. That's how they've all done it. So isn't that how I should be doing it too? So I think, you know, it just becomes ingrained in the way that we do things, that, you know, because I don't think it's I don't think any one scientist or any one institution or anything like that is being malicious, right? And like specifically leaving out women. But I think it's more of this issue of we've created all these blind spots along the way that we're not even paying attention to.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that, how you said you don't think it's necessarily malicious, because I think it's easy to almost get sort of like fired up and angry and like, oh, how terrible, like, women are being left behind. And like, yeah, it's a shame and it's sad and it's frustrating and it needs to be addressed and corrected, I guess. But I guess also it's just like, it just is how the world has been and how it's come. And there were just less women doing sport. It was less accessible for women and it was harder. And I guess it's typically been like more sports typically for men, I guess, historically. And I think that's definitely shifting. But I think too, there's, as you said, blind spots. Like I think there are certain spaces where people just read the research and go, oh yeah, that applies to everyone, and forgets that, well, actually, hang on a second, like, does it apply to everyone? I think there's lots of things that potentially do, right? But I even think like the first thing that comes to my head is, and this is like a bit of a tangent, but intermittent fasting. And that's something that I read into years ago. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Like, I'm going to do it. And I did it for years. And then later read that it wasn't even on women. And then more research has come out since. And like, it is not so much of a good thing for a woman. And it's just crazy. Like myself, like I studied science at uni, like a physio, I'm someone who reads research all the time. Yeah. I still just was like, oh yeah, that applies to everyone. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy, the subconscious bias that we often have, and just forget that there are differences. Like, I think is it Stacey Sims who says like women are not small men? Mm-hmm. Is it Stacey Sims or
yeah?
Yeah, like and we're not, and you know, as much as I sometimes would like to be, I'm like, no, I'm not, and I need to respect that. So it's very interesting.
I mean, I think I had a very similar kind of experience too, right? It's like I was pre-med in college. So, right, like taking all the science classes so that I can apply to medical school, have always been interested in science and all of this stuff, and thought also that I was, you know, pretty well versed, or at least like science literate. But the same thing, you know, as a journalist, I would cite a lot of these studies and just wouldn't even question, right? Mm. Like that I just, you know, made the assumption that, yeah, that should apply, like, you know, it should make sense, or, you know, not even thinking about like if there were differences that were significant enough, right, that maybe there should be some sort of caveat in this article saying it's like, well, that, you know, this applies to men, you know, not necessarily women. But I think like that's the thing though, right, is that at least when I think about it from my perspective, in part it's because I never learned about female physiology as something more than just our reproductive systems, right? Like when we learn about female physiology, it's only with respect to, you know, fertility and, you know, our hormones in that respect. Like we don't talk about it, or at least here in the States, or at least when I was growing up, right? Like I never learned about the fact that my hormones had all of these other jobs that they do in the body, aside from just coordinating my fertility, right? So I think because of that, because we think about female physiology in such a siloed manner, that we lose sight of the fact that there are these other potential effects that might matter, right? Like when it comes to like exercise and performance and injury, or frankly, anything else, right? With respect to our health and our bodies.
Would we be able to talk a little bit more about the menstrual cycle and about that? Because I think it's definitely changing. Obviously, we're living in a world of a lot of shift, a lot of change, which I'm very grateful for. But it's definitely not something that I would have felt comfortable talking to my coach as a 10-year-old, 12-year-old. You know, I remember getting my period and going to swim training for the first time. And this is like a lot of information. It was a bit of an overshare, but like having to use a tampon and being like, oh my goodness, like how am I going to go like at swim practice? But like it just wouldn't be something that you would tell anyone. Like it would be just such a like, gosh, like coach does not need to know anything about that. And I think the thought is starting to shift a little bit more, and there's starting to come this awareness about respecting different times of the month and how your energy is going to fluctuate. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about your learnings around that and some things that you might have uncovered in your research for the book?
Yeah, I mean, just to your point, right? Like, absolutely. It's really uncomfortable talking about that stuff with coaches. And also because so many coaches and athletic training staff are men. And again, I think it goes back to this thing where, you know, we've made it such a taboo topic. And I personally, again, think it has to do with the fact that, you know, it does have to do with reproduction and fertility and sex, that we make it this thing that we can't talk about. Whereas the menstrual cycle, like it is just part of a person's, a female body's like physiology, right? That it's a key part of that physiology. So it's one of the most important bodily rhythms that we have. So like, you know, akin to like the circadian rhythms, like our sleep wake cycles, it orchestrates so many different things, like this incredible like dance of hormones in our bodies. And like I was saying before, that those hormones play such a huge role in like our overall health, right? So not just, you know, whether or not an egg is going to be, you know, released and then fertilized and like all this stuff. But it plays a role in everything from like bone health to, you know, muscle mass and like maintaining and gaining muscle mass, to cardiovascular health, gut health, immunity, like all of these different factors that again, we never really think about or learn about. And so what I think is really interesting now with the menstrual cycle piece of it is, on the one hand, there's a lot of research going on trying to understand how those, you know, female sex steroid hormones affect things like training adaptation, performance, injury, right? So really trying to understand almost those secondary jobs of those hormones and how that might influence someone's experience in sport and physical activity. And then I think part and parcel to that is, you know, this recognition that for people who menstruate, the vast majority of us experience some sort of symptoms, right? And a lot of times those symptoms can be negative, you know, whether it's cramps, headaches, fatigue, all of that can influence whether you want to train, your motivation to train, how you feel when you are training. So I think it's also the recognition that those are like very real factors that can get in the way of someone's, you know, training, and then potentially like if it's like game day or whatever, their performance, right? So thinking about like, well, how can we better mitigate or potentially mitigate some of those symptoms so that you can show up on like your training day or your race day feeling the best that you can, no matter where you are in your cycle, if that makes sense. So I think like those are two really interesting parts of the menstrual cycle conversation that's going on. And then you have things like cycle syncing and like everything that's on TikTok, which is like, I think a whole other conversation we can get into.
But do you think based on that then that women should start to look at their cycle and potentially structure their training around that and potentially look at doing a harder week at a certain phase of their cycle, maybe a deload week during another phase, or do we just not know quite enough about that yet?
I think generally we don't know enough yet, right? You know, there has been research done, right, in the past. There is a body of literature, but there needs to be more. You know, we really are just starting to ask a lot of these questions and kind of validating and building up that evidence base. What I think, you know, is from my perspective, again, like most important from this whole kind of menstrual cycle, cycle syncing, kind of paying attention to your cycle conversation, is the fact that women and girls do start to pay attention to what they're going through, what their individual experience is, right? Because I think what's tricky is that everyone's cycle is different, right? Like it's not just a textbook 28-day cycle. Even if you're the same, you know, you and I are the same age, we're on the same day of our cycle, we might have vastly different experiences of what, you know, whether it's symptoms or even just hormonal levels, ratios of hormones, all of that is different. You can't quite make a blueprint out of that. So I think what's important is the fact that it is getting women and girls to just tune in more to themselves and what's going on. Because again, I feel like a lot of us haven't been encouraged to really be body literate and to pay attention to what's going on in our bodies. We're kind of, you know, again, just like told to just like ignore it, don't worry about it, like, you know, whatever the issue is. But I think that that paying more attention to yourself is really empowering. And I think that's really where some of the power of this stuff, you know, can come into play. Because if you start to notice what's going on in your body, if you're tracking it over, you know, several months, so like not just one or two, but, you know, ideally probably like three or six at least, you can start to notice any trends and you can see whether that those trends really are linked to your, you know, potentially linked to your cycle, or if it's like a one-off thing, or even, you know, or whatever it is. But then you, again, have more information that you can then use to make decisions like, okay, I know that the week before I get my period, I am just done, right? Like I have no motivation to train. I'm really tired. So maybe that does mean that week I deload, right? Like I'm not training as hard. I'm not pushing myself as hard, and also not kind of making myself feel badly about that too, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's a reason behind it. Or even you can use something like, you know, kind of calibrating it based on like RPE, right? Rate of perceived exertion. So even if, say, like on your training schedule, it's supposed to be, I don't know, say like a six or like a seven or something like that, you can still work out at that perceived exertion level. But that might mean, you know, you're not lifting as heavy weight or whatever, but you're still working at that same intensity. So you're still getting that same kind of purpose out of your workout, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, this is so great. I really like hearing all of that. I think it does seem to be like so much power in paying attention to your body. And I think that could apply to men as well, obviously without the same cycle as us, but in general, paying attention to how we feel. And this is something that I encourage my patients to do, whether it's managing injury, like pay attention to how it feels before, during, after, and even just from like a mental health perspective, like being aware of how you're feeling is so important. So I think, yeah, I guess it's great that that applies then from thinking about our menstrual cycle and thinking about the phase that we're in and using that to adjust our training, especially if it becomes predictable as well. I think that's really cool because there's definitely a lot that's come out now that almost seems like so at the other end where, you know, and you sort of mentioned like the things on TikTok and where we've sort of gone from like, oh, there's all this men's research to trying to like rebel against that and being like, yeah, no, like women shouldn't be doing this on this day and they must be doing this on this day. And yeah, exactly like you said, and from what my understanding is as well, like we just don't quite know yet that that's true and that there is set types of workouts that you should do on set days. And so it's nice to hear that you've been able to like see through that research and dispel some of those myths that are already sort of like popping up and getting branded on social media. Yeah.
Well, I think even right, like you see a lot of these plans that'll say like in your, you know, early like luteal phase, like do X, Y, or Z, or, you know, or whatever it is. And like I said, like usually it's based on this idea of like a 28-day cycle, but not everyone has that. But if you really are trying to, you know, sync with your cycle, like you'd have to test your hormone levels. You know what I mean? Like you don't know really what phase you actually are in at any one point, unless you're actually testing and figuring that out, or, you know, using, you know, an ovulation kit or something like that, so that you can know like, yes, I ovulated, so, you know, I'm in this part of my cycle now or something like that. So yeah, I mean, I feel like there is this absolutely a hunger, right, for information, and people want to know. But I think, you know, it's important to go like look at these things as like with a critical eye, right? Like as a critical consumer.
Yeah, I think having that awareness and understanding, and I think appreciating that there is more and more coming out, and it's exciting to see, you know, women taking charge and suggesting these new protocols, because we just haven't had any of these ideas before. So I think while we don't know the full picture, it's nice to have a little bit more interest and understanding, and at least people putting some ideas out and trialing different things and seeing, you know, if that style of training works for you. But I think the awareness and knowing your own body And, you know, noting down your symptoms and doing all of that sort of tracking can be really helpful, as you said, and then you can make your own picture from there. Can we talk a little bit about the nutrition side of things? And I know we've spoken before about how women aren't just small men, and we need different things and we require different things to fuel our performance and just for general health as well. So I guess just to talk about a little bit about the narrative of, you know, being thin equals better performance, being lean is going to mean that you're faster, fitter, stronger, and how that has kind of been played out more so in women, and from potentially male coaches passing that on to female athletes, and I guess the risks with that, and maybe the risks with long-term calorie deficit and being at that really lean weight, and how that might not transfer to performance.
Yeah, I mean, very small topic, right? I think especially in endurance-based sports, right? Like running or cycling, triathlon, body composition matters, right? Like you can't say that like it's not a factor. Like it is a factor, like, and it can play a role. I think where we get into trouble is when we focus on that as the only thing as a predictor to your fitness and your performance and your potential success. I think that's where we get into a lot of trouble. And I think that especially for girls, especially for younger girls like this, and, you know, collegiate age and all of that, this is where a lot of trouble kind of comes in, because if they're looking at elite level, say marathoners or runners, they're looking at women who are in their prime, right? They're in their late 20s, 30s, or, you know, they're older, they've gone through the full maturational process, right? And these younger women are comparing themselves to these older women who've already gone through and like have matured into their adult form, right? Whereas, you know, in your teens and early 20s, you're still developing, you're still trying to, you know, get there, if you will. So I think the problem is like when we focus in solely on weight, we miss a lot, right? And we put so much emphasis on that, and it creates this, again, this idea that if I just cut weight, that will make me faster and successful, right? Because it's a easy thing to focus on and hone in on and grab onto, right? Because like you have a scale, you can look in the mirror and something like that. It feels like, in a way, something you can control, right? But what we often see is that if there's this like brief period, if you will, of like, yeah, good performance, right? Your times come down, you PR, and it's really enticing and it's really seductive. So you want to keep doing that. But what usually ends up happening is that then, you know, a little bit further down the line, the athlete will experience usually injury, you know, some sort of overuse injury, bone stress injury, potentially burnout, potentially their performance starts to level off or fall off, right? And it seems like it's not working anymore. And so the problem is that when you restrict calories and you're not giving your body all the fuel that it needs to not only just live its daily life, right, but to support your training, your body's pretty smart. It's like, thinks it's starving, and it starts going like, hold on a second. And it starts to like shut down all these non-essential systems, right? So like the systems that it'll start to shut down are like reproductive system, your growth system, all of those. And it'll focus on only those things that essentially will keep you alive. But the problem for women is that when you shut down the reproductive system, you start to shut down the menstrual cycle too. And like we talked about before, those hormones play such an important role in so many other aspects of our health. So that there will be almost this cascade of like physiological changes that happen, right? So that's why we see, you know, bone health start to deteriorate, because you don't have that same consistent surge of estrogen, which is really important for, you know, maintaining bone health. You'll start to see things like changes in cardiovascular health too. So you'll see, you know, in folks that do have low energy availability is what they call it, their blood work will start to look like someone with, you know, heart disease, like an older person with heart disease and the like. And so it creates like all of these problems down the line that you don't always see immediately, right? But it does affect long-term health and it affects performance, right? So you'll also see detriments in performance. Like we talked about, you'll get slower, you know, might not be as powerful. And it's almost like, is it worth it, right? To kind of put your body at such risk for like, literally it feels like this small window of time in which you perform really well. And so I think it's definitely something that we need to keep talking about a lot because these myths still persist about like thinner is faster, like you said, or like losing your menstrual cycle is a sign that you're fit and, you know, in really good shape and it's a good thing. These are all things like we still need to talk about, unfortunately, but hopefully we're starting to normalize some of this a little bit more.
Yeah, I think it's tricky, isn't it? And similar to what you're saying within the research where these messages get passed down from professor to student and similar thing with coaches. And obviously it was just a totally different era 50 years ago when maybe the current coaches were athletes and they're just taking what they knew then and sort of passing it on. So we really need to kind of break that cycle and open up the conversation. And I think, it can be quite damaging, especially from an early age if you're exposed to those messages. So hopefully just by talking about it, I guess that's probably the best thing we can do, right, to try and to break that stigma. And I guess on that topic as well, I know Lydia mentioned it earlier, but the research in intermittent fasting while we're on the topic of nutrition, did you come across any more specific information for women? I know that we've got some positives that have come out from the research for males, but is there anything new in terms of intermittent fasting for women?
Yeah. So actually I realized I didn't answer your question in terms of, you know, the differences between men and women. And so this is where like the intermittent fasting and even like ketogenic diets and stuff like comes into play. And so, like I was saying, like the body is smart. It's, you know, freaks out if it thinks it's starving. With women, the body is with female bodies, are much more sensitive to any downturn in nutrition. So like it's almost the threshold is much lower for when the body starts to freak out. Whereas for men, the threshold is a little bit higher. They can get away with, you know, being underfueled for, you know, a little bit more than women can before their body starts to freak out. So that's why, you know, something with like intermittent fasting, we do see potentially, you know, some performance, good performance outcomes with men with intermittent fasting. Again, a lot of the research with intermittent fasting tends to be with like sedentary folks or folks, you know, who are in bigger bodies. But for women, you don't typically see those gains because again, you're fasting, right? For a pretty significant period of time. And the body likes to be in balance. It likes to be in homeostasis, right? And so that includes with your fuel levels and your energy levels. So when you have this huge downturn in energy for like a long period of time, again, the body freaks out and it starts to shut down all these systems and it doesn't respond in the same way. And similarly, you know, with the keto diet, it's essentially, you know, a similar effect that's happening. Like the body doesn't have enough fuel. And in particular for women are also much more sensitive to downturns in carbohydrates. So women need carbohydrates, like, you know, so all of the low carb stuff, doesn't typically work really well for women because the body needs that source of nutrients, in order to like basically just function, right? Let alone perform athletically.
I feel like I just need everyone to hear that and listen to that and like really let it sink in because it's really dangerous what people are playing with. And often what's presented on Instagram by some sort of guru or expert isn't actually someone who necessarily knows that much. And not always, like there's obviously experts that are on social media as well presenting really great factual, reliable information. And there also a lot of the time isn't too. So yeah, it's so scary and it's so sad. And I think it's just such a shame because there's so many women who are following these things, thinking that they're doing something good for their health And the reality is that they're probably not. And like, you know, myself included, like, I haven't done it for years, but like, yeah, I was like really inspired and interested and, you know, read about the potential performance enhancements and things on longevity and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And, you know, but at the end of the day, I want to have good bone health. I want to have a period. I had so much more to life. And it's such a shame for people that are going into things with this like intention of potentially good health or performance, like something that is quite wholesome. And then the reality is it's like really detrimental. Like I think people would be quite shocked if they actually really realized the harm of just like taking advice from someone who really doesn't know what they're talking about or potentially is like interpreting research that is not specific to them.
Yeah. And I think it has a lot to do too with just as a society, right? And diet culture and everything that we're sold and told to be quote unquote healthy or, you know, attractive or whatever it is. And, you know, it's like, I know for myself, like growing up, all it was always like exercise more, eat less, right? Like, because you don't want to gain weight, you want, you know, all this stuff, but it's almost like that's at odds with what your body actually needs to do, right? Because you're depriving it of any energy and yet you're asking it to do all of this stuff. So it's almost like, how can you expect it to perform well or to feel good, right? And I think a great example of this is with the, in New Zealand, the women who are on the rowing team and were competing in the Olympics. I believe it was after the 2016 Olympics, you know, it's the equivalent of like the national governing board for the sport, you know, I think it's like New Zealand. I can't remember. I'm going to get it wrong.
Yeah, okay.
But you know, like the national sport organization. Yeah, they, you know, kind of evaluated all of their female rowers and realized that all but one had some sort of menstrual cycle irregularity or like didn't have a cycle at all. Right. So there was this big problem of underfueling within that group of athletes. And they made a very concerted effort to change that, right? To improve the fueling of their athletes, you know, getting them to eat more essentially, not only, you know, one specific athlete here or there, but like the entire organization kind of flipped the culture, flipped how they talked about it, flipped their priorities. The athletes themselves were supporting each other in this, right? And so what ended up happening, like I talked to one of the, you know, lightweight rowers who's like, it was really hard, right? Because like for her entire like athletic life, especially as a lightweight rower, like restricting food is like part of what you do, right? Like it's part of it. And she had a really hard time kind of wrapping her head around this idea of eating more, how eating more would help her. But when it ended up happening is like, once she ate more, she realized like she could actually do a workout and get to the end of the workout and not feel totally wrecked, right? And like so tired. She like felt good at the end of the workout, and which then meant that like she could do more, right? Like she was actually adapting to the training, could progress her training and get stronger, get better, get faster, because she was feeling her body and she wasn't gaining any weight because she was doing that. And then, you know, at the Tokyo Olympics, they went on and won. I can't even remember, but like they did really, the women's side did really well in all the rowing competitions. So it just goes to show, I think, you know, fueling your body makes such a difference.
That's so interesting. Yeah. I think you can understand the hesitation when you've always done something a certain way and you've been quite successful, you're performing really well. You don't know any different. You don't know how you could feel or how you could perform. But I think having examples like that where they've gone on to have this great success is so nice. And if more teams and more athletes can hear stories like that, I think they'll be more willing to try this. And they're just going to be so much healthier long-term and so much happier and perform so much better. So it's better for everyone. So that's a really cool story. And I know there's so many more like that within your book as well. So definitely recommend people check that out. Obviously, of course, we will link that below. But if we can pivot a little bit towards more endurance-based sports, a lot of our listeners are runners and cyclists and swimmers. And something that I find really exciting as a woman is the gap that starts to shrink a little bit as we get towards longer endurance events. So past the marathon, ultra marathon, 100K, 100 mile, women seem to be doing really, really well at these really long ultra multi-day events. Can you talk a little bit about that, why that might be, whether it's physiologically or psychologically, or what are kind of the reasons that are coming out around that?
Yeah, it is really exciting to see that gap in performance start to narrow. And in some cases where women are, you know, outright winning and, you know, outperforming men. I think there are a couple of factors. One, it could be simply a sampling bias at this point, in the sense that there are many fewer women who are participating at the high level, you know, at these ultra endurance events. And so the women that are showing up and competing might just be really good athletes and the ones who have dedicated themselves, right? Because like it takes a lot of time and effort to train for, you know, events like these. So it just might be that right now what we're seeing is more like the top end of like the women athletes who are competing at this. Whereas because there are many more men competing, it's like the ability level, if you will, is more varied, right? And so that might be a factor. But I think aside from that, there's some thought around like the physiology of women's bodies might be more suited to longer endurance sports. For example, women tend to have more slow twitch muscle fibers, which are, you know, the ones that are associated with endurance. The fast twitch ones are associated with like power and strength, and men tend to have more of those. So there's a thought that because women have more of these certain type of muscle fibers, they might tire less quickly compared to men, right? Which allows us to cover these longer distances. There's also thought that the way that women's bodies metabolize, because we're more optimized to metabolize fat compared to men. So, you know, the thinking is that might affect, right? Like, because like there's more energy and fat, right? Like it might help us kind of carry us through these longer endurance activities better than men. Like we're less likely to hit a wall, if you will. And the fact that women are on the average smaller than men. So that means we need to take in less fuel. So that might also mitigate some of like the GI problems and stress, which is like one of the top reasons why people drop out of these long distance events too. So I think that like there's a lot of potential pieces of the puzzle that are at play. What I think is interesting is that, you know, as I talked to some of the researchers, they were saying like, yes, there are these physiological factors, but what might be interesting too is like as the distances get longer, the physiological factors that tend to give men an advantage, so things even like VO2 max, right, start to wash out, if you will, or start to play less of a role because the distances are so long, because there are so many other things that can come up. Like, you know, one of the researchers I talked to was like, it doesn't matter what your VO2 max is if you can't keep anything in your stomach, right? Like if you can't fuel yourself and like actually move your body. So I think like that's part of the interesting thing about these ultra endurance events, is because you can't just then rely on your physiology, right? Or just strict fitness in that way. You have to be able to tie together all these other elements in order to put together a successful race. And so there's some thought that, you know, on kind of the mental fitness side of things, you know, women might have an advantage. Women, you know, have been found to like pace themselves better compared to men over the longer term. So, yeah. So I think like there's a lot more research and a lot of questions that still need to be answered around this, but I think it's a really interesting area in which we are kind of seeing how female physiology might be advantageous.
Yeah, it's super exciting space. And I think, yeah, you said there's also like there's something that you're just excited about. And I definitely feel the same, because it's something that I'm interested in myself, like ultra running, and the idea that we're a little bit more even potentially. Obviously, there's still more, I guess, well, potentially different ways to interpret the information that we do have and the research we do have. And then obviously more research that's to come. But it's really cool, because I think I spend a lot of time working out in the gym, and I always think like, oh, like I wish that my push-ups would look how a man's push-ups look, and they just don't. And it's okay, and I've accepted that kind of, but I sometimes just like wish that I could do things like a man can in the gym. It's kind of cool to see that it might be a little bit different in the ultra space. And I think what you touched on about the sort of like mental fitness around pacing is something that anecdotally I've definitely seen, right? Like there is often the man that like sort of like really goes out hard,
yeah,
and a woman tends to be a little bit more cautious, or I'm not even quite, yeah, sure what the word is, but I guess as you said, like just better able to pace, like maybe a little bit calmer, I'm not sure. But yeah, as you said, which I think is really important to highlight, like we don't know yet, like small sample sizes, and
yep,
the fact that the sort of women turning up to these events are often at a top level. So I guess, yeah, more data to come, but it is fascinating.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And even in something like, you know, like marathon swimming too is really fascinating, because there's a lot of really great long distance women swimmers, you know, who have just done so many incredible things. Like this woman, Sarah Thomas, that I wrote about in the book too, is like the first person to cross the English Channel 4 times in a row. I'm like, and it was like a year after she had like breast cancer. I'm like, who are you? But like, I think there's something, you know, again, we could talk about physiology, and there's, you know, some thought about just with women and like higher body fat too, like how that's advantageous for something like swimming and all of that. But even just the tenacity, I guess, to, you know, be able to do something like that and accomplish something like that is like pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think it's so exciting, and excited to see what comes out of it in the next few years. And I guess it's just encouraging for women out there who want to get into that endurance space. It's probably the perfect thing for them. It's really exciting. A chapter in your book that I quite enjoyed was the Shrink It and Pink It, which when I first read it, I was trying to work out what that meant, and I didn't understand. And then as soon as I listened to it, I was like, oh, okay, of course. So just talking about the fact that clothing and shoes and pretty much everything has been designed traditionally for men's bodies and men and whatever needs they have. Are shoes still made based on a men's foot shape? Is that, I'm assuming it's changing. I know that you mentioned Altra, the fact that they've got quite gender specific shoes and the cushioning's different and things like that. Is that commonplace now, or is that still sort of emerging?
I think it's still sort of emerging. I think we see it more in the running space, because there are so many, you know, there's a like 50-50, if not more, you know, split for women runners. So I think that's the space where we're seeing more like women specific fits. Again, like what that actually means and how meaningful that is, I think is to be determined, right? Like it depends on the brand, and, you know, some brands are still just kind of like tweaking like the cushioning of something and saying that it's like gender specific. Whereas, you know, other companies are actually, you know, creating the mold of the shoe based on the anatomy of a woman's foot and like doing all this other stuff. So I think like there is like a variety of, I don't want to say quality, but just like, I guess, meaningfulness of what it means to be, you know, a woman specific shoe. You know, what was surprising to me was that in a sport like soccer, there hasn't been a female specific shoe until 2020, I think, which is kind of bananas to me, given like how popular soccer is around the world, and how, you know, like FIFA makes a big deal about like wanting to get more girls and women playing soccer, but yet we don't have shoes to accommodate that, right? Like even for the pros, they wear like unisex shoes, which is, I mean, essentially just a man's shoe. But like it seems like ridiculous to me. And it's only this year that like Nike has come out with a woman specific shoe. Again, which is like wild to me. So I think that's another area where maybe we're starting to see a little bit more movement, hopefully. But it is also kind of a little discouraging, the fact that like we haven't seen more movement in that area until recently.
So what are the issues with a woman wearing a men's shoe then? And like what are the main differences with a woman's shoe that you come across?
Yeah. I mean, again, this is all kind of like general, right? Like, so, and every one individual's foot might be different, but in general, like the shape of a woman's foot is different from a man. So the forefoot tends to be wider in a woman and our heels tend to be narrower. There's also, you know, potentially, so for a sport like soccer, there's potentially some different loading patterns in how, like when you step and kick and all of that, differences between a man and a woman, which would affect how the cleats and blades or, you know, whatever is placed on the bottom of the foot, right? So, you know, with some of the soccer players, they've like shaved down cleats because it's uncomfortable because like the act where that cleat actually is in an uncomfortable place because again, it's not made with a woman's loading pattern in mind. And so what if a woman is trying to fit into a man's shoe, what can often happen is that you get the size, like length, right? But then it feels like the forefoot is too narrow. And so you could go up in size, but then so that it fits your forefoot, but then you'll slip in the heel or vice versa, right? And so it creates all of these things where you're having to make compromises in how your shoe fits and how comfortable it is. And I mean, we all know like it stinks when you have a pair of shoes that doesn't fit and isn't comfortable or causes blisters and all of these things. And you don't, and then it makes you like not want to go for your run and you just want to go home and like all of these things. And I can imagine, you know, if you're playing at a higher level of sport too, like it's even more pronounced, right? And it could potentially lead to injuries. So I think like, again, it's one of these examples where women have been asked to like, just make do with what you have. Because really what difference does it make? It's just shoe. It's the same or whatever it is.
Yeah. It's interesting because I guess my physio lens is like thinking about different injuries that we see more commonly in men and then more commonly in women. And there's certain things that we can point to like, oh, well, this injury is common with this and like that particular posture is more common in men or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't always delve into more specifics and like thinking now about the footwear that I've worn in the past. Gosh, you're right. Like my ankles are usually a bit more swimming in a shoe and a little bit tighter around the forefoot. And yeah, you're right. There is always that little bit, or at least for me, there has definitely been a compromise with shoes, like having it just that little bit wider. So it's more comfortable around the bulk of my foot, but then my ankle might be just a little bit sort of loose and it just is what it is. Don't really think too much of it. So that is something that could be huge for probably the listeners and myself. So it's not really something that I've thought about heaps. So yeah. I really appreciate you riding on that and bringing that up. That's really incredible.
Well, I think one other issue is that, you know, I spoke with a woman who does a lot of like shoe testing and for different brands. And what she said was that a lot of the women just feel like something's wrong with their foot because it doesn't fit in the shoe or it doesn't feel comfortable. And I feel like that's something that has come up, you know, over and over in a variety of different arenas, the sense that like your body is somehow wrong or doesn't quite fit. Right. And so I feel like that narrative then becomes so ingrained in us, right? That we think that like, I don't know, it almost creates like a negative bias, if you will, like whether that's then leads to injury, that then leads to dropping out of sport or whatever it is, this feeling that like, nah, something's not quite right, or I'm not quite right, or I don't quite fit here. Something's wrong with me. And I feel like that's, you know, really kind of terrible. Like it's a terrible feeling to have.
Yeah. I mean, I know from working in a shoe shop, like Soph and I used to work at a running specific shoe shop, and yeah, there always seemed to be like, I mean, most people actually would try and downsize, and in particular women, it was always like not wanting to have their foot too big. It's like this weird sort of insecurity, and that's definitely a thing. And I know women do tend to just frequently wear their shoes a bit too small, and so commonly, like almost always when people come into work like to see me as a physio, they're like, oh, what do you think of my shoes? And I just like put my hand around their sort of 4 foot, and I'm like, they're way too small. And they're like,
yeah,
oh no, like they feel really good. I'm like, I can see your foot like bulging off the side of the shoe, like the fabric is so stretched, like they're so small. They're like, oh, are you sure? I'm like, yeah, like it's crazy. But I think, I mean, there's probably so much wrapped in that, like, but just that narrative of like feeling self-conscious in our bodies, or yeah, like we're not quite right and we just sort of have to fit in. And it probably is not just footwear, right? Like there's so many facets of life where people are either shrinking themselves or thinking there's something wrong with them for why they don't fit in or whatever it is. So
yeah
it's quite sad really, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is there any particular areas that you think have just really not been researched yet, or are like an area where you think is going to sort of like emerge as like the next big thing for women in sport?
Yeah. I mean, one area for sure is around the menopause transition. There's like, it's like a black hole. There's like nothing there. You know, in part, I think because we just don't pay attention to older, you know, more mature women, if you will. And we just kind of forget about them. And, you know, any research that has been done kind of looking at, you know, pre, peri, postmenopause women usually has to do with like more health related stuff. But so there really isn't any research or a lot of research that has to do with, you know, sports science, exercise physiology, like more on that level of what it means to train, what it means to still be performance driven, what it means for like athletic injuries in that way. So I think that that's an area where people are starting hopefully to pay attention to, and we'll start to get some information, you know, over the next couple of years.
Yeah. Awesome. I think it's such an important area, and it's such a shame that that whole group of millions, billions of people have just been ignored for so long.
So many people.
it's wild, isn't it? So good that things are changing. I think it's really exciting. I feel very hopeful and excited for the future, and really appreciate you bringing all of this to light and bringing so much attention and bringing together lots of stories from a variety of different people and all over the world, and sports people and scientists and all sorts of things, and putting it all together in a really nice place. So I'd really, really recommend anyone who hasn't already read your book to check it out. We'll have the links below. But just again, it's called Up to Speed, The Groundbreaking Science of Women Athletes. We'll have your Instagram below as well, and your website. There's so much information that you share. So really, really encourage people to check out the book for themselves.
No, thank you so much. This has been such a fun conversation. I appreciate you inviting me.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time, Christine. I know our listeners are going to have so much value from this episode. So yeah, really appreciate your time, your knowledge, and all your hard work into creating the book. We just love what you do. So thank you so much.
Oh, thanks.